This episode of The Dig is brought to you by our supporters on Patreon.com and by Verso Books, which has loads of great left-wing titles, perfect for Dig listeners like you. One new book that might be of interest is Extreme Cities, The Peril and Promise of Urban Life in the Age of Climate Change by Ashley Dawson. In Extreme Cities, Ashley Dawson argues that cities are ground zero for climate change, contributing the lion's share of carbon to the atmosphere, while also lying on the front lines of rising sea levels. Today, the majority of the world's megacities are located in coastal zones, yet few of them are adequately prepared for the floods that will increasingly menace their shores. Instead, most continue to develop luxury waterfront condos for the elite and industrial facilities for corporations. These not only intensify carbon emissions, but also place coastal residents at greater risk when water levels rise. In Extreme Cities, Dawson offers an alarming portrait of the future of our cities, describing the efforts of Staten Island, New York, and Shishmaref, Alaska residents to relocate, Holland's models for defending against the seas, and the development of New York City before and after Hurricane Sandy. Our best hope lies not with fortified seawalls, he argues. Rather, it lies with the urban movements already fighting to remake our cities in a more just and equitable way. Extreme Cities, The Peril and Promise of Urban Life in the Age of Climate Change by Ashley Dawson. Out now from Verso Books. Welcome to The Dig, a podcast from Jacobin Magazine. My name is Daniel Denver, and I'm broadcasting from Providence, Rhode Island. One thing that Americans hate even more than paying taxes is paying taxes while super rich people get a huge tax cut. In Washington, Trump and the Republican Congress, short on legislative victories, have decided that it's better to do something horrible than nothing at all. My guest today is Arthur Delaney, a senior reporter for HuffPost in Washington, D.C., where he has covered politics and policy since 2009. Arthur explains that it's a nightmare of a proposal, but that we have good reason to hope that it could very well implode under the weight of the very same sort of contradictions that have repeatedly sunk Obamacare repeal efforts. Before we get started, we've only got one more week or so to meet our monthly goal of 100 new supporters on Patreon.com. We put loads of work into the show and don't paywall a thing. So we depend on you voluntarily supporting the independent left-wing media that you listen to, i.e. us. So real quick, hit pause and go to patreon.com/thedig. That's patreon.com/thedig. And contribute what you can. Thanks, and on to the show. Arthur Delaney, welcome to The Dig.
Thanks for having me.
There are obviously a lot of moving parts here, both in terms of specific proposed changes to the tax code and in terms of the underlying politics. Let's start with the big picture and then drill down after that. Republicans are billing this as a middle class tax cut, but the centerpiece of both the past House bill and the pending Senate legislation is a huge cut to the corporate tax rate. Can you give an overview of what's in the two bills?
It's just like you said, both bills cut the corporate tax rate from 35% to 20%, and that costs more than $1 trillion, and everything else in there basically is swirling around the corporate tax cuts. There are other littler provisions that don't cost as much, and a lot of provisions on the personal side of the tax code that are actually designed to replace some of the money they lose to the corporate and individual cuts. So I think it's important for people to keep their eye on the ball. It's the corporate tax cut that is the most important part of every version of the legislation in both the House and the Senate.
Dealing with some of the specifics of those particular measures that are all in there to pay for the corporate tax cut, what are the most important, both in the House and Senate bill, and what are the primary differences between the two?
Well, another funny thing about it is they do pay for some of the corporate tax cut, but they didn't make any effort to actually totally offset the cost of the bill, which is kind of contrary to everything they've said about fiscal responsibility for the past 8 years. But on the household individual tax side, they get rid of tons of deductions and exemptions. And while they say that this is about simplifying the tax code, these deductions are things that basically everybody uses in order to reduce their taxable income. I think the mortgage interest deduction has gotten the most attention, but the biggest thing in there is they get rid of personal exemptions, which literally go to every single person in a household, reduce that household's income by $4,000 per person. And that raises a ton of money. So they don't like to get into the details of all the deductions and things that they're losing, because it's those are the reasons that they can't claim, they can't guarantee that everyone would get a tax cut under this bill, because without all the deductions, some middle-class households, and especially upper-middle-class households, would probably have higher taxes.
Who does pay for the Republican proposal? Obviously, it will deliver huge cuts to corporations, but it also will hit highly paid professionals. And then there's also this kind of entire sectional geographic redistribution thing, which, as far as I know, is pretty much unprecedented in American history, where there'll be a huge transfer of wealth from high tax states, which are also states that by and large voted for Hillary Clinton, to lower tax states that by and large voted for Donald Trump.
I think most of that is driven by what they do with the mortgage interest deduction. Now, they keep the mortgage interest deduction in name, but effectively they gut it because of the other changes they make. They get rid of most deductions, and they also double the standard deduction, which currently 70% of taxpayers, instead of like adding up their expenses for mortgage interest, charitable giving, and all kinds of other stuff, they say, you know what, I'll just take a standard deduction, and that's a much simpler way of dealing with your taxes.
Yeah.
So with a doubled or almost doubled standard deduction, this is actually kind of funny side point. They say they double the standard deduction, but for a family, it would go from $12,700 to $24,000, you know, which is like not quite doubled. So anyway, because they increase its value so much, a lot more households would take that, and it would be a lot less valuable to itemize. So it's that combination of factors that would result in only like 5% of households. It would only be worthwhile to take the mortgage interest deduction for like 5% of households. And that's a huge deal. It does affect like metropolitan areas with really high home values, because you'd have to have a lot of mortgage interest in order for it to add up to more than the doubled standard deduction. And that happens to mean a lot of blue states, places like New York and New Jersey and California, that have these extremely big real estate sectors. And so it's like a rich, you know, you could imagine it's a geographical redistribution of wealth from Democrats to Republicans.
There's also the deduction of the state taxes, right, which is going to get cut under both bills. I'm a little confused about that.
Yes, that's the other. It's mortgage interest and the state and local tax deduction, which allows people to write off the amount they pay in local taxes on their federal tax bill. So the combination of getting rid of that and doubling the mortgage interest deduction, and doubling the standard deduction, are what makes the mortgage interest deduction so much less valuable. Now, this has been a huge political problem in the House of Representatives. They had to cut a deal in order to pass the bill. They cut a deal with Republicans from states like New York and New Jersey, and kept a just the property tax deduction. So your state and local income taxes You still couldn't write them off, but you could write off up to $10,000 of property taxes in the House bill. Now, the Senate bill doesn't have this carve out because there are no Republicans from those states in the Senate. So this is going to be a big problem when it comes time to merge these bills together, if they do ultimately pass the Senate version. And I don't think there's, you know, you can't, I don't think it's reasonable to assume that they will get to this point. But if they do, they'll have to reconcile that in order to win over some of those Republicans in the House that they basically bought off by giving them a little bit of property deduction.
Because these blue state House Republicans are already in incredible peril this coming November, passing on
huge
tax increase to their constituents doesn't seem like it's going to help matters much for them.
No, and it's funny how they seem so desperate to get something done just because they feel like they haven't done anything and they need an achievement. And it sounds like analysis, but that's what they themselves say. It's so weird. You say, Congressman, why are you doing this legislation? Like, what's the big rush? Why is it so important? And they just say, well, our voters won't vote for us. Our donors won't give us money if we don't do it. But politically, the bill is not popular at all. They have not written an appealing piece of legislation, and I don't really see how it helps them to say they passed this thing, especially if they're bringing home a big fat tax hike. That's the opposite of pork. That's like, what's the food equivalent of that? It would be like they're bringing home fake bacon or like a soy burger.
Turkey bacon. God forbid. I'm interested to hear how you think Republicans came to this analysis, to this conclusion that it's better to pass an wildly unpopular bill than no bill at all. I understand why it makes them look stupid and ineffectual to not be able to get anything passed. But the only thing that seems worse than that is to get something passed that is going to increase the chance of their most vulnerable House reps in blue state suburbs getting knocked out in 2018. I don't get that at all.
Well, they know that they campaigned with these promises. They, you know, they said they would repeal Obamacare and do tax reform and all this other stuff. So they did say that they would do it. And it's on the one hand, it's as simple as keeping your word. A more cynical view of this is that the rich people who give them money, who would benefit the most from it, say, we'll stop giving you money if you don't do this. So you better do it. So I think you could read it both ways at the same time.
So I get the politics at play where Republicans are happy to do whatever their wealthiest, most nefarious donors want them to. But what I don't get about that.
Let's be clear real quick. Like, one guy literally said this. Chris Collins, the Republican from New York, said, our donors say they wouldn't give us money. Like, wow, did you just say that out loud? I mean, we all thought that, but that was refreshing. So sorry to interrupt.
No, that is refreshing honesty. But yeah, so I get why, you know, like Mercer types call and they're like, do this or you're cut off. But I'm surprised that they're so willing to antagonize such seemingly Republican friendly and powerful interests like the home builders and realtors to get this done.
That actually is a really big deal. They have made enemies out of some of the biggest lobbying powerhouses that we've got, because the realtors and the builders can mobilize opposition in every district. And they knew this was coming. They said all along, don't do this. We really hate it. It would tank home values, and we will lobby against it. We'll fly people in. We'll run ads against you. And they did it anyway. So that shows you the imperative of getting the corporate tax cut done, because they're walking right into this lobbyist buzzsaw of real estate people. And I think that's a big deal. I mean, it's a weird thing going on, one of several weird things going on within the legislation. Like, it's, yes, a big upward redistribution of wealth, but at the same time, they're accidentally doing class warfare against real estate. You know, they would upend housing policy. So determined are they to do the corporate tax cut that they would gut what amounts to $100 billion every year in tax subsidy for people who buy and build houses. That's a big deal. I mean, that's more money than the government spends on like every rental assistance and affordable housing construction program put together, and I think it is plausible, like the realtors say, that home values will go down if they do this. It would be like a real earth-shattering consequence.
Another target of the Republican tax proposal are two other targets, related targets. One is university endowments, and another is tuition remission for graduate students and others. Is this simply them looking for money plus scoring political points against people that they and institutions that they don't like? What's going on there?
I haven't talked to a ton of members about those things specifically, but the impression I've gotten is that it's mainly they're looking for money and they want to take out, you know, what they consider special breaks that have been sprinkled throughout the tax code over the years. So it's partly simplicity, partly we need money. But I think you also do have to consider that they want to stick it to places of higher learning because they're going in a fact-free, know-nothing direction with their politics, where they're just really hostile to institutions of higher learning. Plus, these are the places that have got a lot of the social justice warriors that they don't like. But ostensibly, it's just in the House version of the bill, which is harsher than the Senate version on this piece. They're just, you know, flipping over couch cushions and emptying their pockets, and like they're getting nickels and dimes out of these weird attacks on universities.
Yeah, and sometimes the spare change that they dig up can also serve the fortuitous purpose of punching someone in the face that they already don't like, and sometimes it punches someone in the face that you'd really think they didn't want to piss off, like the home builders and the realtors. I want to ask about the whole process question of how this is working. It's going through something called budget reconciliation, which is why there's some limit on how large a hole they can blow in the deficit. Is that right?
Yes, but it's pretty easy for them to use gimmicks to get out of this. So the way it works is they pass a budget, and having done that, they can then use budget reconciliation, which the main advantage of this is that you can get the legislation through the Senate with a simple majority, only 51 votes, whereas normally you would need 60. And since Republicans only have 52 seats up there, they'd need 8 Democrats. They don't want to do this with Democrats. So they're going the reconciliation way, but it has constraints. And one of those is it is not allowed to increase the deficit after 10 years. So 10 years being the traditional budget window they look at, there's this extra rule in the reconciliation process called the Byrd rule, which prohibits you from adding to the deficit after that 10-year period. And all the legislation they're doing clearly would, but the way they get around it is in the latest amended version of the Senate bill, they just say, you know what, all these tax breaks for individuals will just expire in 2025. And then poof, the deficit in the later years just goes away, even though this is ridiculous. Why would you give us an expiring tax cut that would set up a fiscal cliff and a political emergency in 2025? And they're just like, yeah, don't worry about it. That's literally what they say. Like, future members of Congress who may or may not be us will prevent that from happening, which is the same thing that did happen with most but not all of the Bush tax cuts.
Have you spoken to Republicans on the Hill who have in the past expressed a opposition to deficits that bordered on the religious and are now defending a massive tax cut that will massively expand the deficit? And if so, what do they say?
They quickly pivot to it's not the deficit itself, it's the spending. So that's obviously their real enemy, government spending on social programs, things like
it's funny that they didn't say that at the time.
Right, because it's not popular to say I am against this spending that benefits many people. You don't want to say that and get thrown out in the next election. So they say I am against fiscal irresponsibility, you know, whatever form it may take. But then when they're presented with a form of it that they actually really like, which is tax cuts, this whole fiscal responsibility goes out the window, and it turns out actually what we don't like is spending. And there's a built-in This is also a neat trick, because if they do get it through and it massively increases deficits, then in later years, the deficit argument becomes all the more urgent, because the deficit will be wider and the debt will be rising more quickly. So I think that's a built-in benefit that they don't ever explicitly tout, but that they know will help them in the future, even though they're exposing themselves as not really caring about fiscal restraint right now.
As intellectually dubious as deficit hawkishness is, are there any actual true believers on the right in Congress in terms of like actual opposition, bedrock philosophical opposition to deficits? Or are they all down to the last one only concerned about deficits insofar as it can be instrumentalized to starve the beast and redistribute wealth to the rich?
Well, there are a couple things. There are ways to imagine that a bill that clearly would lose all kinds of revenue actually isn't as bad as it seems. And this is when they talk about dynamic scoring instead of static scoring. So static scoring, the Joint Committee on Taxation says, well, if you reduce all these tax rates by this amount, the amount of revenue coming to the Treasury will go down by this corresponding amount. And Republicans, what they're saying now is no. You can't look at it that way, because what would really happen is you'd reduce these tax cuts. These businesses would be so happy that they'd hire lots of people and everyone would have more money and buy more things. And the whole economy will be so much happier that more people will be hired. And then the government would collect additional revenue on sales and payroll taxes. And the actual fiscal impact of this won't be as bad as it seems, because this is Reaganomics. This is the Laffer curve. We'll get more revenue.
It goes back to a certain non-peer reviewed napkin.
It's a fairy tale. Do you remember the Bush tax cuts that happened like recently?
Yeah. We can actually examine something that we just had this experiment in real life. We can look at it. Actually,
did the debt go down? No, it went up. It's so weird to try to have this argument. Like, you're starting from such a place of illogic that what are we even supposed to say? And it's funny. It makes reporters, you know, if you're just describing things factually, it sounds like you're analyzing them or arguing or like really calling them out. But that it puts everybody in a weird position. But there are some members who are at least saying that they don't like this deficit stuff. And one notable one right now is Bob Corker, the retiring Republican senator from Tennessee. And he has suggested, but not outright said, that he would oppose the bill if it adds to the deficit. But I think no one really takes him seriously. Everyone figures that he'll fall in line when it's really time to vote for this.
Well, that's what I want to talk about next, which is that I feel like our best hope for this bill's failure is that, like Obamacare repeal, there are just too many moving parts in a party that is built upon too many contradictions, and that any effort to tweak the Senate bill to please one group of dissenters will only create a new crop of dissenters that will put them lose them necessary votes in their stead. How do you see this playing out? How do you like handicap it?
I do a podcast called So That Happened for HuffPost, where I've been making unnecessarily bold predictions. And my bold prediction for this is that that tax reform is going to flop. They can't do it. And it's for exactly the reasons you said. It's like healthcare reform, only even more complicated. And they just
added healthcare, Obamacare repeal to it.
Yeah, they're like, this will make it better, because it gave them money. So it allowed them to say, look, these tax cuts are even deeper than they would have been without this extra money. But it instantly made it more fraught. I think it made it easier for Susan Collins to say, I don't like this. But there's a question of whether they really want to include Obamacare in their tax reform, or if it's just a ploy. And this is not, I asked John Kennedy, senator from Louisiana, if that's what was up, and he said no, but it is a theory that you're putting this in now so that when you take it out later, it makes the bill seem all the more reasonable to the members who are not so gung-ho about it. So it could be a trick, is what I'm saying. But I do think that the overall politics of tax reform is just as fraught and littered with pitfalls as the healthcare debate. The thing that's different, though, is that they do really seem a lot more desperate now, specifically because they blew it on healthcare. They feel like we really got to do something now.
To what extent are they attempting to hand out goodies to win over particular senators? I saw that they added drilling the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which seems like a clear effort to win over Republican Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski. Do you think it will win Murkowski over? And how much other stuff like that is going on?
The clearest giveaway so far has definitely been the property tax deduction thing on the House side. And honestly, I'm less sure which of the changes they've made in the Senate were specifically targeting wavering members, you know, because no one has come out and said they're against it except one guy, Ron Johnson of Wisconsin. And it's clear that they can give him what he wants. He's upset about this, their lower tax rate on business pass-through income, because he is a businessman who, you know, collects business income on his individual returns. That's what pass-through income is. It passes through your business to your individual tax return.
That's the majority of businesses, right?
Yeah, most businesses are set up this way. They don't represent the most money, because regular corporations do, but it's a sizable chunk. And reducing this rate is going to create a logistical nightmare for the IRS, because they have to prevent rich people from reclassifying themselves as businesses in order to dodge the higher individual income tax rate that would remain. So they said we're going to have guardrails, and they've proposed some solutions in the Senate version that Ron Johnson said he didn't like, but I think everyone assumes they'll tweak it so that he can say he's happy. But it's another thing that gives the lie to the argument that they're doing this to simplify, because this doesn't simplify at all. This is going to make the tax code have a lot more pages in it, this pass-through business income thing.
Yeah, so under the current proposal, and even under kind of any conceivable alteration of it, you have this extremely incoherent and unfair system of a 20% rate for corporations. I think at present, the pass-through rate would be about 32%. Is that right, if I remember correctly?
It would be – what they want is 25%, but then there's going to be differing rates depending on – your role in the business and the way the business is structured. It's complicated, just like they said it wouldn't be. It's going to be like really, really complicated.
But then there's still the much higher top marginal rate for income. And you have all these people rich people trying to incorporate themselves as pass-throughs.
Right.
Or however that works. So it sounds like chaos.
Right. Under present law, you already have people gaming pass-through income just to avoid payroll taxes and a Medicare tax on higher incomes. It's like 2.7%, I think. And a famous instance of this is John Edwards setting up his law practice as a pass-through and saying that it was all business income, even though it was clearly the result of his doing work that generated the income.
John Edwards, classy guy.
Right. So he claimed it was passed through income and therefore didn't have to pay this kind of trifling Medicare tax on what was clearly wages. And so that already happens, and they're going to make a much wider differential between the individual and pass through rate. It's, you know, you ask any expert and they're like, yeah, this is going to be a pretty big problem. Pretty big payday for accountants and tax lawyers.
Before I let you go, I just want to talk about something we've sort of been referencing the entire interview but haven't looked at directly. But if you could just go over and underline who wins, who loses, and more or less by how much, and leave the listeners with that.
People with higher incomes in businesses win the most. And partly that is just because people with higher incomes already pay the most taxes, and they want to cut the income tax brackets across the board. So inevitably, the richer people will benefit the most. And the way it looks right now, the losers are going to be families with multiple children in high tax areas like like cities in New York, New Jersey, and California, because they're going to lose the special exemptions for their family members, and they're going to lose the deductibility of a lot of their local taxes. And, you know, a side effect of that is that the states and local governments are going to lose too. So it's going to create, if they were to ram it through as they're on their schedule, it would have a lot of disparate effects that are hard to predict. And that's part of the reason they're moving as fast as they are.
Arthur Delaney, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Arthur Delaney is a senior reporter for HuffPost. Thank you for listening to The Dig from Jacobin Magazine. As Marx once sketched out on a napkin, while other podcasts have only interpreted the world in various ways, our point is to change it. We are posting new episodes every week, usually two, sometimes more. The Dig was produced by Alex Lewis, music by Jeffrey Brodsky. Our Postmaster General is Christian Bowe. Follow us on Twitter at The Dig Radio, and please find us wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe. And if it's on iTunes, please leave us a glowing review. Those reviews do help introduce us to new listeners. So does spreading the word to your friends. All propaganda on our behalf is greatly appreciated. Also appreciated is your financial support. If you haven't already, go to patreon.com/thedig and make a contribution. Even a few bucks a month is a huge help.